Woo! Little housekeeping we have to do now. I know you're ready. American Baptist Reimaginers, sit up and take notice. Our meeting this evening for dinner. To join them, sign up at the Connections Board and meet together at the Skyway entrance at 5:15. We have established a lost and found at the registration desk for anyone who's interested. We are aware that people are losing these wonderful booklets. We encourage you to put your names in them if you have not already. And we encourage you to be respectful if someone uses the book to mark places at table. If you would like another book, you may purchase one for $5. We don't have an abundance to, and we can't give them away, but you may purchase them. To keep all of these memories and good things alive, tapes of all the sessions are available from the Resource Express. Their booth is located outside the door. A portion of the cost is rebated to the Reimagining community. I forgot to bring my copy with me. Pam, will you hold yours up? We want to be sure we're all reading the Daily Reimaginer. There's lots of good things in there for us. We also want to invite you to keep in mind, well, to remind you that we don't want to take pictures in this space. That has been our policy and practice. So please help us to keep observing that practice, if you would. And finally, we also want to keep in our prayer throughout the afternoon the people of Nashville and the downtown, which was struck by tornadoes yesterday afternoon. And I'm aware that two people have died, and the city is in a disaster kind of state. So let us keep the people of Nashville close in our hearts today too.
If you'll stand by me. Well, I do our
stand by you.
Stand
so
by
duets
me. Yes.
Stand by.
I asked Marianne Lundy to stand by me, and we thought, boy, we've always needed to stand by each other since 1993.
Or not.
Or not. Yes. Marianne Lundy calls herself, and actually the two of us call ourselves, the unindicted co-conspirators.
Actually, I got indicted.
Marianne is a symbol for us, is she not? She bore the brunt, for many of us, of the violent backlash that happened in 1993. Marianne and I were talking this morning about all of the connections among us and the connections among the speakers and others here, and how we've worked together in so many ways. For example, Marianne and Beverly Harrison were at seminary together and has, who'd you work with in the YW? Bregelia Baum, and so on. And what we concluded was that there truly is a global community. And Marianne is truly a representative of that global community. I met Marianne 18 years ago or so, 17, something like that, and at St. Luke Church in Minnetonka. And became active with her in the sanctuary movement. And she's also a symbol in that sanctuary movement of the 80s, not only a symbol, but an activist. And so I present to you Marianne Lundy, and I feel truly privileged to be able to do this.
Last Sunday was Easter in the Western world, and though it may have been an accident of timing, it's especially significant that we are here at Reimagining 2 in the week following Easter. For it was Easter 1988, 10 years ago, that the Ecumenical Decade, Churches in Solidarity with Women, was launched by the World Council of Churches. And Reimagining 1 was conceived as the major U.S. event that would celebrate the midpoint of the decade. Easter, therefore, now for many of us, is viewed with added significance as the decade called us as women to roll away the stone and witness to the resurrection of the living Christ in our midst, just as those first women did centuries ago. At dawn, they were walking, sadness in their hearts, spices in their baskets. In the midst of the lost, they urged themselves into action, myrrh and aloe and balm in their hands. In the midst of the paralyzing reality, they took their steps, alone in their grief, together in their walk. But the stone, the huge stone, disconnecting the women from the beloved one, prevented them from doing what they felt to be so natural, so necessary, so crucial. The scent of the spices is strong, and the need to transform their emotions into action is obvious. And the stone occupied their minds. It became bigger and bigger, and the worry almost put them down. We are too weak, they said to each other, too small, too few of us. The smell of powerlessness and helplessness became stronger than the aroma of the spices and framed their spontaneous conviction. Did we come here in vain? Do we throw away these spices? Isn't it better just to give up, to try to forget? Morning is coming in the garden, life celebrated in all its color. Grief is touched by beauty. Sadness is comforted by new beginnings. Slow steps and silent minds are changing into laughter and into joyous cries of discoveries. Come here and see this. And the stone, the huge stone, was rolled away. And the perfume of the day was hope and joy. Life changing reality. Full of life, full they ran to share everything they had seen. The disciples, having stayed behind locked doors and not knowing yet what had happened, what is happening, opened only the door, not their minds, not their hearts. Idle tales, we do not believe you. The late night tears of sadness turned into tears of rejection and frustration. This is the beginning of the report on the Ecumenical Decade, The Women's Journey by Irja Askola, one of my colleagues from Finland. Has a familiar ring, doesn't it? While many decade events took place in the United States from 1988 to 98, the one, as we know, that overshadowed all the rest was the Reimagining Conference. Thousands of books, articles, studies, lectures, and debates later on all aspects of it, it has been called by both secular and religious writers the watershed event for contemporary American religion. Strange, isn't it, that such an important event could have aroused such opposition? But then there's that first Easter and the witness of women. And so we ask ourselves, what has really changed? What are the stones that still exist that have to be rolled away? Who is to do it? What is the cost of rolling away those stones? The obstacles to opening the tomb of death to let in the fresh breezes of a new wind of the Spirit. Is it the disciples themselves? Is it all of us in the churches who too often don't see? Questions for the decade worldwide and questions for us here now. You may remember that the decade was inaugurated by the World Council to bring the agenda of the prior UN Decade for Women into the churches, to bring a new awareness of women's gifts and leadership, of their new contributions in theology and spirituality, to challenge the churches to break down the oppressive structures and power dynamics that keep women out of decision-making, to acknowledge the work of women in areas of justice and peace. And then the churches were asked to stand in solidarity with women in their struggles in church and in society. Who will roll away the stones? At the end of the first 5 years, by mid-decade, and at the time of the Reimagining Conference, the answer worldwide was more apparent than ever. You women, you see the stones, you do it. Very little ownership by the churches of the decade was being expressed. By 1993, women's hopes were turning to frustration. It was becoming a decade of solidarity of women with women. Thus, it was decided by the International Committee to give the decade back to the churches, and we would do that by team visits to all 330 member churches of the World Council, living letters, we called those teams, and we'd talk with churches about the main stones, the obstacles for women. We chose four: violence against women, women's lack of participation in the life of the church, the global economic crisis and its impact on women, racism and xenophobia and its impact on women. 78 teams of 5 women and men, usually 3 women and 2 men, 220 persons in all from every region of the world visited 334 churches, 70 ecumenical councils of churches, and more than 600 women's groups. Living letters sent to the churches for face-to-face encounter. Living letters to the churches, we met them during our journey, women in towns and villages, in kitchens and parish halls, who carry sadness in their hearts, and yet the scent of life in their baskets, who worry, serve, and care, each in her place, and yet take steps, finding each other on the way, coming across one another, on the path of the Easter garden, women who, in spite of all, wake up at dawn and urge themselves into life. We met them during our journey, women in conferences and meetings, in offices and backyards, whose enthusiasm has dried up, whose commitment has been killed. They see the stone, but only the stone. They have turned back, some with bleeding hands. The stone is too heavy, too stubborn, too entrenched, too hard. We met them during our journey, women in fellowship groups and clubs, and prayer meetings and theological schools and parish councils and quarters, women who carry in themselves a wound, ashamed of their talents because they'd been told by the church leaders that they didn't know enough, that they're not theologically correct, they don't quite understand yet. Women who stopped blossoming because nobody believes what has happened to them. And we met them during our journey, endless numbers of women who were weeping. But nobody asked them, "Why do you weep?" Not even the church, who has promised to follow the way of Jesus. All over the world, the decade has become real in the lives of women, in regional events, national gatherings, drumming, singing, praying, reading papers to each other, sharing their experiences, dancing in Zaire and Korea and India and Mozambique, Canada, Nicaragua, Taiwan, Fiji, events as significant for those women and those churches as reimagining was for us. That's why when Conrad Reiser, the General Secretary of the World Council, my colleague, was asked, this was before I went to work for the World Council, was asked by the press at the 1994 General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church in the U.S., "What do you think of the Reimagining Conference?" It was kind of a trick answer, I think, they sent to a European outsider. He could answer in truth, "Ooh, it was not at all out of the ordinary, not so extraordinary that women are doing theology, speaking out of their own experience." He went on to say, that nothing so new seemed to emerge, for, you see, he knew, he was aware that women all over the world are challenging the churches in their places with such theological and liturgical insights based on creative and sound scholarship in their context, often opening up the issues that most of the churches, as here, do not want to face. "Read the books," Conrad might have said. "Women have been doing most of the theology lately, folks. You haven't been listening." That was what reimagining was about, wasn't it? Doing our theology in the open and acting it out, becoming the church. One of my male colleagues in Louisville said in the aftermath, "What the churches couldn't accept, I think, isn't what you said, but that you showed us all how to be church. You didn't just talk about it, you were church there." Who will roll away the stone? Is that a rustling in the garden that I hear? And so, at the end of 10 years, what have the living letters revealed? Well, women have found each other, hands reaching across the globe, reaching across denominational, even religious, lines. New ecumenical bonds formed. In a few instances, such as the Presbyterian Church in Korea, churches moved, in this case, to ordain women as clergy and elders. Women finding their rightful place in church. And in churches in South India, there's a new program involved when assisting women to be able to be those decision makers. A program also to improve the economic situation of women through local, simple, down-to-earth programs. In Kenya, churches are helping to set up income-generating programs for women. Tanzania reports that a program to bring women and men into joint decision-making in the churches is taking place. On and on it goes, and I want to build on, I think it was Mary last night, who said, "We need," or maybe it was Rita, "we need to talk about the small victories because they become larger and larger." In Togo, in Pakistan, participating in the decade study has meant a greater awareness for all of the contributions of women. We met men during our journey, men who wanted to see what we women have discovered, who shared the joy of our findings, who were not afraid of our tears, who did not become defensive. We found men in the garden who walked with us, joined us, who wanted to know more, who dared to ask before answering, to listen before teaching, who took the risk to feel, and believe that it is all true. Those 80-plus men who attended the first reimagining conference, we came to call the FGMs, some of us, the few good men, who stand with us in partnership against the negative forces. They were the ones who often spoke out about what they had experienced and voted with us in those sometimes awful presbytery meetings, those inquisitions. So women and men have found each other in theological discussions, in a thirst for new possibilities. And new communities of faith, as with the reimagining community, are springing up. Most of you, I'm sure, belong to those communities. Women in many parts of the world, as documented in the United States in the study Defecting in Place, are staying in the churches, staying in place, but defecting by forming their own, often ecumenical groups, to provide the acceptance and solidarity for nurturing their faith and through theological study and creative liturgy, all in a safe place. I like to think of these groups very much like the early church, the house churches, the communities of resistance. They take many forms: afternoon groups, evening groups, some meeting for breakfast. They meet to find strength to trouble the waters, to roll away the stones. In my own denomination, it took the form, after reimagining, in the creation of a group called, what else, Voices of Sophia. Listen to one of their illuminations, shades of Julian and Norwich, or Hildegard of Bingen, I like to think. In the radically inclusive spirit of Christ Sophia, we call the church to a new reformation, to practice equality of all people, to reject dominating power, and to affirm equal opportunity for the expression of diverse gifts within the discipleship of equals. We call the church to welcome and celebrate the gifts of all people. Groups who are saying, we will carry on the spirit of reimagining, though we be critiqued, criticized, harassed, fired, or excommunicated. We will stay in this church to work for its reform. Jesus, the living Christ, is with us, moving us in our day, as did this same Jesus recalled in the pages of the New Testament. Who will roll away the stones? Who will trouble the waters? And they are saying, we will. Women, women all over the world joined in the spirit to break the stones, battered and bruised, perhaps. Woman, why are you weeping? But women surviving. How have women survived? What are we learning as we go along, as Mary Bednarowski asked us that very first session of the first Reimagining Conference? What are we learning about ourselves, about our faith, about each other, about God, about the communities we live in? I want now to try to talk about, in a kind of personal way, what have been my learnings, or if you will, my reimaginings. In the aftermath of reimagining, what was it we learned? I want to do this, and it's not very easy for me, because I know that many of you here suffered enormously because of the distorted reporting of the conference. Those of you who were clergy often lost your jobs, lived with the threats in the so-called name of purity, of the purity of the church. What have we learned? And how do we keep up? How do we keep going on with this joyful task, but difficult task of reimagining? In sharing these things, I hope we'll continue to make it possible to survive together. First of all, we learned, didn't we, that we have to tell our own stories. We were naive. I think Mary called it innocent. I thought we were naive, and we let others tell the story for us. We learned that their words, motivated by their own interests and theological and ideological presuppositions, as Bev helped us to know, will use our experiences, our words, for their purposes. Suddenly, we learned that phrases taken out of context could be interpreted very, very differently, especially if fed by just the right nuance. You know, all of them are feminists believe. Suddenly, you don't recognize, we don't recognize ourselves anymore. And the truth of the experience is so purposely distorted, the report is meaningless to us who were here. Were they at the same gathering, we ask ourselves? A mockery, and I think the painful part is a mockery is made of what we believe. And then worst of all, we're made voiceless by the scared religious structures. Idle tales. We do not believe you. And intimidation works. It silences those who have much to lose in power and authority. And so we've learned that we need to speak for ourselves, and we need to write it down. I was thinking as I was looking at some of the resources, how many of the details we've already forgotten of the beginnings of the process of reimagining. The book helps us, the reimagining book, to retain some of the details that are very, very important for our own history. And also to help us see the connections among us all, the connections that happen sometimes in the very ordinary events of our lives. We who have strong, articulate voices were made voiceless, and we have to ensure that we tell our stories first, tell it and write it. We have learned that troublemakers rarely start out to be that. We're not necessarily ordained to this calling, or are we? Yes. Prophets, perhaps, they once were called. We've learned that if we stand on the side of change, very often we're viewed as troublemakers. Troublemaking has to do with seeing differently, feeling the cacophony, hearing the silences that speak so loudly that we can't hear anything anymore. Not being able to be silent any longer, we become troublemakers. Troublemakers is often a quiet, behind the scenes, plugging away at the church. And because it is women's stuff, it may go unnoticed. Maybe reimagining has changed all that, however, once and for all. I remember in 1987, when I left the National YWCA, where I had been working, I announced that I was going to leave to take a job with the Presbyterian Church. And one of my colleagues wrote me a note saying, "What's a nice girl like you going to work for a place like that?" We have learned, we women who are brought up to be nice girls, that we have a right to be angry, a right to our rage at those who deliberately misrepresent us. We have a right to be angry at the churches which have nurtured us, brought us up, and called us leaders, to be angry often at even our women friends, our colleagues, who, when the heat is turned up, say, "They didn't remember that." At the churches that have given us the glimpses of justice and a better world, that have read scriptures to us from the prophets, that held up to us Mary and read us the Magnificat, and then we take it seriously, and they say, "Oh, for heaven's sakes, where did you learn that?" That's not what we meant at all. We have a right to be angry at the churches and the church leaders in presbyteries and synods, in conferences and dioceses, who say, what's the plural of dioceses? Dioceses? Who say, you know, I really agree with you. I do know, but this is not the time in the church's life. Our funding is already precarious. And the General Assembly is coming up, and we just couldn't stand one more controversy. So if you make the motion, I'm afraid I'll call you out of order. We have a right to be angry at the timidity of the church, of its preoccupation with its own survival. We have a right to call our churches to accountability and their leaders for their lack of responsiveness in doing honest theology, for keeping a secret from the members the biblical scholarship that would enable all the members to ask the hard questions that reimagining asked about the place of women in the records, about power, about authority, about what Jesus really said, and what the Bible really says or does not say about the difficult issues of our day. Our churches and our clergy, for the most part, not us in this room, of course, are lazy. They avoid doing the hard work of empowering the people in the pews with the tools to reimagine for themselves. Instead, they encourage them to live with a safe, numbing faith that sits fat and self-satisfied. We have a right to be angry also at the seminaries who train us up and then often stand back when the time is needed for the support, for the sending out, for the building of inclusive community. We have to be angry, and then we have to let it go. All the anger before it becomes paralyzing bitterness that rants and raves, that becomes the very thing at which we are angry. We're learning to deal with our anger as we go along, as a surge of energy that impels us forward. We're learning to channel it into constructive energy. I learned, much to my surprise, as one who did not express her anger very well, as one who often held it in, when one of my colleagues at the World Council recently said, wow, you really are articulate when you're angry. Express it, and then we're learning to let it go. Then I think we learn that it's a gift to be expelled from the center. Maybe I learned that. To be expelled from the garden. We have to sit on the margin. What is so terrifying at first, especially to those of us who have been at the centers of authority, if not of power, is that we feel marginalized by our own churches. We are marginalized, turned out even further past the boundaries, into the water, up to our waists and getting deeper. It's where we remember suddenly, perhaps we're called to be, to name the idols, to challenge that very center, to name the demons. We remember then that it's in the marginalized community of pain shared that we are most welcome. With refugees and migrants, with the homeless, in places of conflict, the death places, with battered and bruised and raped women, with abandoned women, with lesbian women and gay men, women of color, we learn that realizing the pain of our sisters, but being with them as they survive, helps us to know what can be born. In the communities of the outsiders, we learn not to be so afraid. We gain strength from each other to stand against the forces that would purport to divide us, that seek to win in order to gain power. From the margins, we gain a different kind of power to stand alone, and also we learn that it's more important to stand with others in their struggles very often than it is to keep on with our own personal struggles. It was first in the sanctuary movement in the 80s that many of us caught a tiny glimpse of what it means to be literally an outsider. When Central American refugees entrusted their lives to us, telling their stories of fear and the search for freedom far, far from home, who expressed their living faith in a living God far from any kind of security, they gave us a gift of faith far beyond what we had ever imagined. Their trust became a kind of thread that bound us together, that moved us all to decisive, risky action, that pushed us to take risks that none of us would have believed possible. Outsiders who helped us insiders to become outsiders, for that's where we're called to live out our faith. And we have to keep asking the question, the very important question, who is missing from the family? Who is not in the center and the leadership, and why? Because they're unacceptable, black, poor, gay, lesbian, single parent, mother, drug addicted or alcoholic. And then we have to work at pushing the boundaries out to a truly inclusive community. Out, out. If those boundaries can't be pushed, if the waters are too deep and the currents too strong against us, then we have to reimagine new communities as Jesus calls us to do. And then we've learned again that it's not the answers we have, but the questions that are the most important. We know that, don't we, always? It's about living the questions, and that's pretty scary sometimes. In the midst of our doubts, we've learned to keep asking the hard questions, especially the ones that make our churches so uncomfortable. Who can be ordained and who can't? What kind of a God would do this? What ways are the most racist that we are practicing? Why are we reducing the women's office staff? Whatever happened to the social justice unit? Where have all the flowers gone? What good does it to survive if we aren't making a huge difference? What good does it do to have all that money in the foundation if we're not making a difference? We have learned that troubling the waters brings anger and confusion and terror and a certain kind of loss, responses that we cannot fathom. It means being in pain, feeling the deep pain of being alienated, of being separated. It means getting terrible phone calls from church elders. Do you know what I'd do to you, little girl, if I ever met you? I'd put you in the basement to scrub the floors. Are they righteous or are they scared, those church elders? It means getting black plastic garbage bags full of postcards, letters purported to be from Presbyterians when they're not at all. It means being afraid to answer your own phone, losing, 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 being ridiculed and charged, even charged with heresy. That was one of the better parts. Where are you, oh God? You surely can't be in this mess. What have I done? In the biblical record, it's called Sheol, the pit, hell. Troubling the waters will most certainly drive us into the pit, where we ask ourselves, will this never end? How did I get here? What have I done? And we want to crawl out somewhere into the light and forget it all. Down, down, but truth to tell, it's in the deep, dark, those dark times, if we stay with them, that we learn the most about ourselves and our God. One of my colleagues in campus ministry once said to me at such a time, stay with the pain, Mary, stay with the pain. It means diving down deep And in some mysterious way, when you're most alone, it happens. A breeze, a flutter of wings, and you're not alone. It's okay. A breathing wind. And you're borne up on wings. I think sometimes we don't want to stay with the pain. We want, especially maybe we strong women, tend to want to solve the problem quickly, to objectify it, to analyze it in order to fix it. But we've learned to internalize it, not to blame ourselves, but to live who I am. Hard stuff. The power become weak to be with us and in us, the presence that we seek made known in the depths, made strong in our most vulnerable time. Finally, we learn that we are ultimately okay, that God, that mother hen who spreads her wings and protects her chicks, suffers with us and ultimately heals. Strangely, we are mended, and mysteriously so. I learned also that when we're in trouble, we need, like the refugees did, a safe place. A safe place toward which to flee. A safe place just to be. A place which holds us in our brokenness, which brings us home in the deepest sense. For me, the place was northern New Mexico, Ghost Ranch. Many of you have been there. It's to be where we can be at ease with ourselves and alone and safe. I don't fully understand this, how it happens, but somehow the place itself becomes mother. We open ourselves to nature, to earth, to rock, to sky, to light. Something elemental about that connectedness. And it nurtures us back to health. We need this space, you see, especially because the spaces we have called sacred and that are called sacred by our faith have expelled us. And so someone else's sacred space won't do it anymore. We have to find our own hallowed ground. It's finding home in the deepest sense. Nell Morton talked about it in words like, "The journey is home." We have to leave home to find home. We have to wander in our own wilderness to find again the God who can be trusted to lead us, to accompany us. The search is the destination. Later, for me, Hartford Seminary was to be that place. Strange, an academic community, and I'm not an academic, surrounded by a small community that welcomed me not because of credentials or of demands, but for friendship and support. And they took risks in doing that. They lost two trustees, and yet they took me in. And then in surviving the troubles, we have to come to a time, as I said before, of letting go of the whole thing. In a sense, letting go of the whole event. Not forgetting it and not belittling it, but letting go of the grief and sadness and letting it become the history, the stories of our corporate life. Not letting it have destructive power over us any longer. That came finally for me when I could speak about reimagining. I suppose it happened when I decided to work for another bureaucracy, the World Council of Churches. And I suppose it has something to do with forgiving, that handing it over, so that we can get on with the business of living. There is, of course, what we all know. If we're in the business of troubling the waters, very soon, we'll figure out we can't do it by ourselves. We'll be surprised by the friendships, because there's no way we can do it alone. There's no way to get through it, to swim head on. The gift of friendship. I cannot tell you the importance of the people. I knew I was going to do this. The women and men Presbyterians and disciples and Catholics, all of you, all who sent the letters and phoned and faxed, offered me your homes, your books, your empathy, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of you in prayer. I finally could not thank all of you personally. Now I'm just going to cry about it. And so all my friends said, don't get up there and cry, Marianne. But let me tell you just a few. One day I got a call, and it was obviously a man with a southern accent, and my secretary at the time said, I think you want to take this call. And I said, why? And because I had had from a certain part of the country a number of calls from men, as I explained. And she said, well, it's a call from Amarillo, Texas, and he's called you before. So it turned out to be a doctor, a social activist, an oncologist in Amarillo, and we developed a marvelous relationship. He sent me books of those who've stood in the hard places, because he himself is there trying to change the church he grew up in. A woman in Seattle who took it upon herself to write me monthly for at least a year. We've met, our friends, and she would have been here today, except she has to have knee surgery. Poets like Jan Richardson and Mary McAnally, who wrote in their anguish and sent me their poetry. Colleagues in Louisville who wore bells on green ribbons to say, we will not be silenced. The United Church of Canada, I don't know how many of you are aware of this, and I don't know whether the Canadians are here, whose executive committee took action in support of this conference. Remember, we sat at round tables with 45 of the Canadians, and a young man who's since been ordained writes me a Christmas letter every year and has my piece of cloth, remember the pieces of cloth we brought, has it in his study. The executive committee took action at the United Church of Canada in support of the conference and in support of me. The young reporter for the Washington Post, who was so shocked, he was young, that all of this was happening to such a mild-mannered, middle-aged woman, he thought that. His name was Bill Broadway. I don't think he's covering the conference, but he convinced his editors to run a full-page story on me on the Saturday issue of the Washington Post. I hope he still got a job. Then the Sophia Valentine, recorded by one of my friends in her own, it's one of those Valentines you open up and all of a sudden I can do, Sophia. In her own inimitable bass voice. And the monthly liturgies planned by the women and men in Louisville, creative and powerful, singing and crying at the same times, Meg and Rebecca and Sharon and Mary, some of you are here, and to cry and to rail and to laugh, not to mention the eating and drinking. I've learned about these kinds of gatherings all over the world, in women's living rooms, in South Africa, in the Y in Uganda, in the village square in Salvador. I think I'm messing up the tape, Sal. The bottom line on this one is that when we're in deep trouble, we need most of all to laugh at our own smallness, ants that we are, to laugh at the ridiculousness of it all, to laugh at our own fears and projections, and of course to laugh at the enemy. Parker, you won't believe what we laughed at about you. Boy, that did me good. You see, that's one way to regain our perspective. And then you know that God, too, is laughing with us. Don't take yourself so seriously, girl. We need also, and I'm getting to the end here, you'll be glad to know, we need always to remember that the world is bigger than the United States of America, that that the church is bigger than our denominations. That trouble is the life of women all over the world. That violence and death are a large part of most of the world's women's lives. That we who are here owe them a life that is abundant and free from fear. Knowing that we can't make that possible, we have to stand with them. We need to remember that we are, in fact, a worldwide church. We women know that. And when we forget about denominational identity and minister to a broken world, we are doing what we're called to do. We need to find our community also, I think, with the secular world, with women's groups who are working in the same for the same goals that we are. Gabriella in the Philippines, peace groups in Japan, WILF in this country and around the world, NGOs, the World Health Organization, in our own communities and globally. You see, to be feminist is to be ecumenical in the broadest sense of the word, the whole creation, oikoumene. We are learning that to be ecumenical is to move beyond the boundaries of Christianity, to be with women of other religious traditions, Jewish, Muslim, Hindu, Buddhist, to listen to their experiences of faith, to speak about what is ours to share all together, the deepest fears and the visions, and to find ways to act together. That's what ecumenism is about, reaching out together to a broken world. Finally, we're learning that it ain't over till it's over. That the troublemaking won't be over in our lifetime, and so we need to train up others to be radical ecumenical troublemakers. We need to tell the stories of the victories, as small as they may be, and to be together in the rough places. We need to remember the resurrections and celebrate the rolled away stones. And then we've learned we need to move on. We have to trust the smile on future's face. As I was thinking about this, I was thinking about who would have thought it. I was thinking about who would have thought 5 years ago that we would have fomented, where's Sally, the watershed event that reimagining became. Who would have thought that Presbyterians would be studying Sophia all the time and reading everything that Dolores Williams has ever written? Who would believe that seminaries are even looking seriously at liturgy, and that and that Chungkyung's outfits are liturgical garments, and that the General Assembly Council of the Presbyterian Church has met around round tables, that Rita Nakashima Brock has become a late night television personality? You see, yesterday's heresies are tomorrow's Book of Order. In the garden of that Easter morning, Mary experienced the appearance of Jesus. He was as caring as before, came close, but softly started with the question, "Woman, why are you weeping?" In the garden, she met God, whose first question after the resurrection was addressed to a woman who was troubled in her heart, in tears and in grief. In the deepest moment of Christianity, in the first hours of the resurrection, there is space for a question. There is an interest in and attention to a woman who weeps. And in the garden, Mary, Salome, Joanna, Peter, and the others remember. They start to remember, and they know they have to leave the garden. They cannot worship an empty tomb. The risen Jesus is already on the way to Galilee, waiting for them with the promise, calling them to move on. We met them during our journey, women and men who know it is time to move on, baskets full of daffodils and crocuses, hearts full of encouragement and visions, who sing the song of life, remembering those who went before us, celebrating those who walk with us, blessing those who will come after us, telling again and again the story of the rolled away stone. Singing the song of life, moving on, calls us to keep on reimagining. These are dangerous days for imagining, days when burning bushes are turned into piers and seers are taken as scapegoats. 300 years ago, they killed the heretics in presses of stone and at fiery stakes. 300 years after the fires went out in this land, the witch-hungry presses are still around, now spewing glossy and slick and justice mistaken. And in this land, 3 years later, there is still much at stake. More than jobs, more than positions, more than orthodoxy. 300 years ago, those women knew what this is about power and naming, about claiming holy things as their own. I tell you this, 300 years later, women are crying out that there is better news for these days. I have seen it, breaking bread at the table, embracing the brokenhearted, touching with oil the wounded and weary, laughing and dancing and singing and free. It is beautiful, I tell you, and it is strong, and it is rising. Amen.
It's called being fired up. Thank you for your courage and for giving us courage. Thank you.
sing back what you hear.